After nearly 5 years of appeals, Dino Moretti, reputed lieutenant of the Franco crime family, was released from prison today and acquitted of all charges in connection with the murders of police officer Frank Castle and his family. Moretti has long maintained his innocence and claims he has no idea who is responsible for the 125 mysterious gangland murders, often attributed to a shadowy figure known as the Punisher, which have occurred in this city over the last half decade.
Hello and welcome. Welcome and hello. This is Wait, You Haven't Seen. It's a show where we talk about movies, and specifically, we talk about a movie at least one of us has never seen before. I'm your host, Travis, aka TV's Travis. This is episode number 264. And the movie this week is 1989's The Punisher. And joining me to talk about it, returning to the show, it's Jay Dimes. How you doing, man?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. All right. So before we get too deep into it, what's your history with The Punisher? 1989's The Punisher.
So I probably watched this in the late 90s when I was in high school. So we used to have this video store around the corner from my house. And on Tuesdays, it was $1 new releases and $2 catalog movies.
Okay.
And I would basically walk in on Tuesday and I would like just pick up a stack of movies and I'd watch them over the next couple of days. And Punisher caught my eye because one, it's the Punisher and I'm a comic book guy. But Right. Two, because it had Lou Gossett Jr. in it. And my dad was a big Lou Gossett Jr. fan. So, like, you know, Officer and the Gentleman was one of his favorite movies. And so I picked it up thinking, oh, you know, I'll tell my dad Lou Gossett Jr. and he may stay up and watch it. And he did. We watched the movie. But also, like, Dolph Lundgren, I was like, oh, Dolph Lundgren's in this? Like, I, you know, other than, like, Rocky and He-Man, like, I didn't really remember him being in anything. Else. And so I was like, okay, this has got a good cast of people. Let's see how they do it. So I picked it up and loved it. And I think I actually ended up buying it on DVD later.
Nice.
I'm not sure where that DVD is. But yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So I don't remember this movie coming out. But I do remember seeing the box for it at the video store. And I remember hearing about it, but most of what I heard was from people saying, oh, it's terrible. You don't want to watch it. Oh, it's an awful movie. And so it kind of was one of those that was like, it just never made my radar to like sit down and watch. And I didn't have a friend of mine that was real into it. So there was nobody that's like, dude, you got to watch this, you know, this movie and all that. And at the time of say the early 90s, like, my movies were going to be Batman 1989. They were going to be, you know, Batman Returns, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So I just didn't care. And I knew the Punisher as a character. I'd seen enough comics to know who the Punisher was, but I wasn't super into the Punisher at the time either. So I just sort of didn't care. And then it became, I never saw it. And I sort of fell victim, kind of like last week when I talked about Last Action Hero. And I sort of fell victim to the prevailing idea that it was a bad movie. And so then I just never watched it. And like last week, I'm kind of sad that I never watched it because I had a good time with this. It isn't as bad as people have said it is at all. Yep. There's a lot going on here. Now, what I will say is, for me, of the four versions of the Punisher that we've had on the live action screen, between the Thomas Jane movie, the Punisher War Zone, and then the Netflix Punisher series, and this is going to be number four for me in that list. But
ooh,
like,
I think this is number three for me.
Okay. So I definitely want to dive into that. which we will do later. And the main reason for that for me is I have a little bit of connection to, like, it's just I'm sure part of it is when I saw this, having just seen it now and having seen the other ones beforehand. But it's not perfect. So it's the story of Frank Castle. If you're familiar with comics at all, Frank Castle was a former, I can't remember, in the comics, is he Marine or is he Army?
In the comics, his original telling, he is a Vietnam era Marine vet.
Okay. So, you know, he's in the military, then he becomes a cop. His family is killed after witnessing a mob hit, and he goes vigilante. And he started off as a villain in Spider-Man comics, and then became sort of the anti-hero.
Yep.
His timing was perfect because it was what, mid to late 70s when he debuted. I think it was, I want to say it was like 77 ish era.
That sounds about right.
And like, it's kind of perfect for that anti-hero movement because he shows up as a villain, and within 10 years, Wolverine, Venom, and all that kind of stuff is, and those anti-heroes are becoming more prevalent and more popular. And he's a perfect version of that. So he becomes this Marvel anti-hero, gets his own comics and all that. And the rest is history. It is a bit of a touchy subject to some people, the Punisher, based on sort of the co-opting of Punisher iconography by certain groups these days, which, I mean, even Marvel themselves have kind of tried to distance themselves from. And this movie
changed the logo.
Yeah. Which, okay, I'm curious, what do you feel about the logo change in the comics that they did recently?
You know, I wasn't a big fan of it. I like the skull. I will say that they at least wrote a story that explains it of why it looks different. And there was a fair amount of backlash because I think originally they were just going to get rid of it altogether. Like, they just weren't going to use the skull. And then I think they kind of read the room a little more and decided to, like, just do a different variation on the skull.
And it has to do with him leading the hand, right? If I remember correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. So he becomes kind of the leader of the hand, and the skull changes and they add like some horns to it and make it a little more almost demonic looking. But I also get the outside of the storyline reason for doing that as well. But I'm with you in that I kind of didn't like it at first because there's a certain just iconography to a comic. It would be like changing the S on Superman's chest. Yeah. Or, you know, any of those. It would just be, it's just weird. So I'm glad that they didn't completely get rid of it. That's actually one of the things about this movie that I think hurts it in the long run is it's always a balance you have to do when you're adapting a comic book to another medium, especially film, especially live action film, of how do you do the character justice on screen without it looking completely ridiculous, right?
Yeah.
Late 90s, early 2000s, you know, X-Men era, like the first Bryan Singer's X-Men, that kind of era, they were doing the black leather. And while that becomes a very much a product of its time, I get it at the time because it would have been really hard to sell Cyclops in a blue spandex suit with like gold, yellow straps and buckles on it, which is what he's wearing in the comics at the time.
Although my argument for that would be they've done it with Superman since the beginning of time. Like, Superman has that kind of weird looking costume.
Yes, but then you think about the Zack Snyder Superman stuff and they muted all the colors. They toned them way down. So it was a darker blue, a darker red.
But I feel like they could have done that with X-Men. I mean, listen, this is a whole separate digression. But I feel like maybe one of the issues that like X-Men runs into, and I love those movies, I love the single ones more than I've loved most of the ones that have come after his trilogy. But I do think that if they had stuck a little more to the color scheme, that it would have been better.
I mean, I don't disagree with that. I understand the reasoning for not doing it at that time, the late 90s. It would have been tougher to sell than today. But mm-hmm. but I agree with you in that I think the colors work. I think the kind of the hyper real version of a comic book works. One of the things I didn't like about the Zack Snyder Superman was muting the colors. If you're going to have him in a suit that is effectively, for better of a lack of a better term, spandex,
mm-hmm.
Just give us the bright colors. Give us the bright red and the bright blue, and make it that. Which, you know, eventually they kind of do with I think Supergirl in The Flash has a little bit brighter color. Like, Batman is always dark and brooding anyway, so you can get yeah. away with grounding that a little bit more. You know, early seasons of Arrow on the CW stuff.
One of my favorites.
They toned down and they went for a very more realistic look. And then as that series progressed and as they started bringing in The Flash and everything else, they let the color come out a little bit more and they yes. went a little more comic book. And I think all of that worked better.
Yeah,
I think it worked a lot better.
And they've done that in all the Batman movies. Like, Batman has never used an all black costume, like, especially like what they used in 89.
Right.
Like,
yeah, that's true.
This
movie here, The Punisher, comes out the same year as Batman 89, and Batman 1989. So it's hard for people, if you are a fan of movies right now, and especially comic book movies over the last, say, 10 to 15 years, you might find it difficult to believe that, like, the 80s was not a period of comic book movies happening at all, let alone any sort of scale. Like, you had Superman, and until 1989, that was pretty much it. Outside of Superman, comic books were relegated to the small screen, or they were box office bombs like Howard the Duck. Which I got a soft spot for Howard the Duck.
Never
really.
Nope.
I did it on the show a while back. It's fun. It's bad. It's not a good movie, but I have fun with it. And so, but like, that was what was happening with comic books at the time. Was mm-hmm. it was a lot of, like, Stan Lee was trying to get a lot of Marvel stuff optioned, but it was all small screen. It was the Incredible Hulk TV series, the Spider-Man TV series, the Incredible Hulk TV movies they were doing in the mid to late 80s. And you had Superman, and even Superman, by the time of this movie coming out in 1989, Superman had Superman 3 and 4, which were diminishing returns, right? The budgets were shrinking. The mm-hmm. box office was a little bit lower. Like, Superman 4, its biggest problem is it just had no budget. And so it looks like, if you compare Superman 1 and 2 with Christopher Reeve to 4, 4 looks so cheap and so, like, slapdash in comparison. It, you know, it's the difference between a made for TV movie and a theatrical movie. And so, like, that was the landscape of comic book movies at this time. And so this movie gets made and didn't even get a theatrical release in the United States. Like, it was released in theaters all over the world, but the US, it never got a full, like, first run. It played a couple of festivals.
Huh.
And it didn't even play those until 1990, 1991. Because New World Films was the producer of this. They were the studio behind it. They were bought by another company. I can't remember the name now, but the company that bought them had no interest in doing theatrical release. So they went straight to video with this. So it went to video and Laserdisc, but it never got, it never got played in theaters. And it's kind of a bummer that happened, because I feel like this could have done decent. It still made
$30 million.
Yeah. Worldwide, $30 million on a $9 million budget.
Listen, I mean, they did good.
And there were talks of a sequel to this at one point. In like 1990, they were going to do a sequel to it. It never materialized, in part because I guess Lundgren didn't have either a great time making it or he didn't love the final product. And so that happened. There was some kind of behind the scenes sort of making of drama, making this movie. The guy that wrote it, I'm gonna butcher this name. I believe it's Boaz Yakin. If that's wrong, I'm sorry. But he was the writer of this. This was the first script he ever wrote or has credit for, is this movie. After that, he did a Clint Eastwood movie called The Rookie in 1990. He wrote that. He wrote, what else did he write? The sequel, I remember The Rookie coming out. He wrote the sequel to From Dusk Till Dawn, the second one, Texas Blood Money. He wrote Now You See Me.
Hold on. Because Robert Rodriguez is one of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Ian Tarantino. I've never heard that there was a sequel movie, Till Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, From Dusk Till Dawn? Oh, there's like three.
Well, I've seen like those other, like, but this one that you just named is a new name for me. Like,
oh, really?
What was it called again?
From Dusk Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't Dusk Till Dawn. It was just, okay, you said Texas Blood Money. I hadn't heard that part. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that one came out in 99, and it stars Robert Patrick. And it was co-written by Boaz Yakin, who wrote The Punisher.
Okay.
And then he also did Now You See Me from 2013, the movie with the magicians, heist movie.
Yeah, that was him.
Like, he's done a few things. He wrote and directed a movie that came out in 2015 called Max, about a Marine dog. I remember seeing trailers for this. He was a military dog, and then it's got Thomas Hayden Church. He gets adopted by a handler or something. But this was his first movie. And then the director of this was Mark Goldblatt, and Mark Goldblatt, only directed three movies. He directed Dead Heat in 1988 with, Joe Piscopo, which was kind of a B movie. It's got, Treat Williams and Joe Piscopo, where, a cop is killed investigating a strange case of, resurrected corpses. And then his partner and a pathologist resurrect him. Like, it's this weird, goofy 80s action B movie.
Okay.
So Mark Goldblatt directed that. He directed The Punisher. And then he directed one episode of Erie, Indiana. But he is best known as an editor. So he, as an editor, he has edited films like Starship Troopers, True Lies, The Last Boy Scout, Terminator, Terminator 2, Predator 2, like Commando. I mean, the Rambo. He's edited a lot. He knows how to edit action. So bringing in somebody like that to direct this movie kind of made sense if you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this movie suffers from direction necessarily. I think if I had a gripe with The Punisher, my gripe is that the script is a little too overstuffed. There's a little too much in there that they could have trimmed down, consolidated, because we get, so Frank Castle, I do like, we don't have an origin story. We're not getting the origin of how he became the Punisher. He's already the Punisher. He's been the Punisher for 5 years.
Right. Yeah.
So I appreciate that, because I do like storytelling that just gets right into it. But he's been the Punisher for 5 years. He's going after people for killing his family. They kind of changed the circumstances of how his family died a little bit in this from the comics. That was one thing I noticed, was I kept waiting for them to be in Central Park doing the picnic thing, and they didn't do that. But I'm fine with that. Whatever. That doesn't really bother me. But he's going after the mob, and then I think my other problem was, like, you've got the mob characters and Frank's going after them, but then we introduce the Yakuza as well. And now the Yakuza are taking over. So Frank's got to team up with a mobster to go after the Yakuza, which doesn't make any sense to me. really if you know like that character.
Right.
So that's where like that was my main issue with it. I think overall I had a really good time with this movie, but it just felt like they kind of packed too much in and storylines got like okay. So when we open up that that first mobster that comes out of there, Moretti, I think his name is.
Yes.
He comes out of the courthouse, he's been acquitted or exonerated or whatever. And it's a great scene where he's coming out of the courthouse and I captured some audio from it. I'll play in a little bit. And he talks about, you know, like showing the Punisher what punishment really is and all that. But then he's immediately killed off in the next scene and he's kind of inconsequential. Like he doesn't really matter because then we just bring in another mobster to replace him in Johnny. So it's like, I probably would have mixed again, kind of consolidate a few things, combine the Johnny character with Moretti. So Franco and Moretti can kind of be one character instead of two. And maybe he survives the first attack.
Yeah.
And kind of move on from that. Although I did find it interesting that they have an attack on a house with Frank Castle to start off the movie because Punisher Warzone did the really similar thing. Where Frank goes after a mob house, right in the beginning. So,
well, and the Thomas Jane one does it too. They just don't do it at the beginning. They do it. I think that's the end sequence of the movie. They go after. After the house.
Yep. So, you had that, and like the Yakuza stuff again is interesting, but I feel like it's just too much. Like, either start with that, or don't have it at all. Yeah. But they bring that in partway in. And then because of the way they did that, we have no idea why this Yakuza boss, why she does anything she does. She's just evil for the sake of being evil. The point of like kidnapping the children and selling them into child slavery, I guess. And like all of that.
I don't think I was worldly enough to think about this when I saw the movie originally, but now going back, like I wonder if it was like, was it a stretch for stereotype, right? Like we didn't really want to make the American mob really seem like the bad guys. So we put it on like the outside foreigners, like, because you almost feel sympathetic for the mobsters, for a lot of the movie until maybe the very end when you're just like, oh, now you're just going to be a dummy. But like, you know, they get their kids taken, you know, like they're like the enterprising businessmen who are being attacked by foreign interests. Like we don't really experience the mob characters in this movie as being truly like bad guys. They're really used as like kind of cannon fodder for the Yakuza, which I think is an interesting is an interesting way to frame it. But
and again, I think if you start there, if you start with like the Yakuza are moving in and the mob is scared and they almost have to turn to Frank in order to help them take out the Yakuza.
Yeah.
I think that's a compelling way to do it. I just think they missed that part by not starting there. They stuffed a little too much in. It's sort of that have your cake and eat it too, trying to do a little bit too much. It's like all the stuff. So Louis Gossett Jr., as we mentioned, plays Jake. Is it? It's Jake, right? I got it here.
Berkowitz.
Listen.
How does Lou Gossett Jr.'s character end up with the last name Berkowitz?
I don't know at all, because that character was written with no actor in mind. Not Lou Gossett Jr. Like he was not thought of to play a character named Berkowitz. What was interesting to me too is I kept waiting, like I knew this was an early adaptation of a comic book into film, right? And but I still was kind of waiting for, like, I remember the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in 1990 had a lot of really good allusions to the comic that started the TMNT franchise in it. And I kept waiting for stuff like that. And then I find out afterwards, like, Frank Castle is literally the only comic character in this movie. Everyone else is basically created for it, including Berkowitz. But then they get Lou Gossett Jr. to play him. And look, I'm going to say this right now. He's probably the best thing in this movie. Like, Lou Gossett Jr.
Oh, yeah.
Brings it.
Yeah.
He ain't phoning it in. He is intense. He is doing his thing. I loved that. I wanted more of him. There's not enough of him in the movie. I think that's the biggest issue I have with the character, other than Lou Gossett Jr. being named Berkowitz, is there's not enough. Because when he starts off, like, when they, the Nancy Everhard's character, Sam Leary, comes up to him and is like, hey, I want to be your partner. And he's like, I don't work with a partner anymore. Immediately, I know, cool. So Frank was his last partner. And that's why he's so intent on finding him. Like, it's so cliched. But at the same time, I'm like, but I want to know, I want more of this. Like, I want more of sort of that backstory and all of that stuff that's going on. Because the scene of them when they finally capture Frank, when he turns himself in, later on, was great.
Yeah.
I loved that moment.
Let me ask you a question, Travis.
All right.
Because I don't feel like before that conversation, was there any other discussion of the fact, I know where it was. Because I was trying to figure out, had they said any time else in the movie that Frank was a cop, but they say it at when the criminal is walking out of the courthouse. They mentioned that.
So that's the only time. And then the next time we get any mention of it is later on. But like, it's so obvious in that first scene with Berkowitz that, like, okay, no, Berkowitz was his partner, and that's why he's dedicating his time to it. And it's sort of in the comics, they ended up having the character of Martin Soap. Who was kind of Frank's guy in the NYPD that Frank worked with a little bit. And I don't know. Now, I don't know if Soap was created based off of kind of the Berkowitz character or not, like which one came first. I'm not sure about that, but I loved that idea of, like, here was a guy who was Frank's friend, who was his partner, who was like a family member, because a cop and his partner, they're almost family, you know, especially in movies.
And he says that, he's like, when he talks about the wife and kids, he was like, they were my family too. Like,
yeah, exactly. And to have that happen and to have that break. And then that's the thing, because the movie was so overstuffed, and then you, on top of too much plot, you've got action sequences you've got to do. You lose a little bit of that character development that I'd like to have. Yeah. I think if you trimmed down some of that extra plot elements, you could have given more time to Frank and Jake and their backstory and sort of what worked between the two of them. Because I think the more interaction you have with Lou Gossett Jr. and Dolph Lundgren, I think the better. Because I didn't think Lundgren was bad, but he could, and his acting because this is only like fourth movie he had made? Fifth movie, maybe? I think he had done... He had been in the Bond movie, A View to a Kill, but he was just kind of a side part in that. Ivan Drago, and then Masters of the Universe and Red Scorpion. So yeah, this was basically like the fifth movie that he made. And his acting between Rocky IV, Masters of the Universe, and this, you can see his acting getting better. You can see him becoming a little bit better every movie, but he's still a little stiff in parts here. He's still a little wooden.
Which works and some for of this that character.
Sure. In fact, I read that some of it, because one of my notes was like, he just looks like he's ready to fall asleep all the time. Like, he's supposed to be brooding and dark and like upset about things, but he looked to me like he was just like ready to take a nap at all times.
Yep.
And I guess that was a thing Dolph Lundgren actually did. Like, he kept himself from sleeping to look sleep deprived because he felt like that's how Frank Castle would be, which from an acting standpoint is pretty cool. And knowing that, it kind of helps a little bit, because there's moments in this where he's really good. I do think so. Like that moment at the end with the kid, I thought was good. There's a few moments here and there where I think he's good, but there's other times where he just feels like he wasn't given enough time to do the acting parts of it. Now, the physical stuff, like him playing Frank Castle, it's a great look, right? Because, yeah. I mean, Lundgren's a freaking giant.
Right. He's,
what, 6'5", 6'6", like chiseled out of stone. I mean, he's got the body of a Greek god, especially in the late 80s. Mm-hmm. And they darkened his hair, and he looked the part, although the stubble got to me, because that stubble was like, was it me or was that sort of there and then gone and then back?
I think you're right. The stubble is very comic accurate. Like most times when you look at, you see Frank's face in the comics, you can, like, they allude to like him having like a 5 o'clock shadow. Mm-hmm. Pretty permanently.
Yeah, dude would have 5 o'clock shadow at like 9 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, like, yeah. It was.
I mean, when's he gonna shave? You know, I mean, like, he ain't got time to shave.
No, he's busy.
Yeah,
he lives in a sewer, for crying out loud. Like, come on. Which was another moment where when they're in the sewers looking around, and I'm thinking, 5 years you've been looking for this guy, and you never once thought to look in a sewer or a subway tunnel.
I mean, who wants to live in the New York sewers? Like, who would?
So here's a question for you. Uh-huh. Is it New York? Do they? Because I don't know if they ever say it is. And then I read.
I don't
know. I read a trivia thing. Yeah, they don't say it. Like, I assume that because it's the Punisher. But I read a trivia that the map in Berkowitz's office, uh-huh, that he points to with all the red dots on it was a map of Seattle. But they never say, like, what city it is either.
Yeah, so. I think I felt that because I know that the comic, he's based in New York.
Yeah, I mean.
But yeah, I don't think he ever actually said it for the movie. I think I just stuck that in there.
Yeah, like that was my main issue with the Thomas Jane Punisher movie, was honestly just changing the setting, putting it in Tampa, which I got from a like cost standpoint of making the movie, but moving the story to Tampa didn't make sense to me because it sort of, I was talking to a friend of mine, and it's like it would be like having Peter Parker grow up and live in Cleveland. It doesn't work for the character. It doesn't make sense. So much of the character is about being from New York. So much about Frank Castle is he was an NYPD cop and the mafia in New York.
Well, also in the Thomas Jane version, he's not an NYPD cop. He's an FBI agent.
That's right. That is right. I forget about that completely. Which I think that movie is better than I remembered it being initially.
I need to go back and rewatch it.
There's definitely parts of it that that are better than they have any right to be. And Thomas Jane is great. It was changing him from an NYPD cop and moving it out of New York just killed it for me at the time. I can appreciate it more now, but
you know what kills that movie for me? And it kills me to say it. I think Travolta goes too far over the top in that
movie. That is, he is just chewing all of the scenery, right? Like, he is Charles Dance in Last Action Hero levels of scenery chewing. And having just watched that, it's fresh in my mind. But the thing with Last Action Hero was it was meant to be satirical, and so the overacting makes sense. And I think Travolta was, but it was, again, that was what, 2000, was that 04? 03, 04, right in that era? Kind of.
Yeah.
Early to mid 2000s, and so Travolta was doing that. This was not long after Battlefield Earth. Ugh. And you know, that era of Travolta, he was way hamming it up. Swordfish was right around there. Was that was him?
Yes.
And so, like, he mellowed back down and kind of came back. It's funny because, like, him and Nick Cage, we were talking pre-show about Face Off and them both being in that and completely hamming it up there. But like, they both have had kind of similar careers in a lot of ways, but I feel like Cage gets away with more. Like he can go a little further, and like people are just like, ah, that's Nick just being weird. Whereas Travolta gets derided, I think, sometimes unfairly, but in the case of playing Howard Saint in The Punisher, yeah, it was a little bit much tonally to the rest of the movie. I think that's where it comes to. And you know, that just kind of happens. I will say, okay, I'm going to pronounce this wrong. I know it, but I believe it's Joran Krabi.
That sounds right.
As Johnny Franco.
Mm-hmm.
I love him. Like, when I see him, my initial thought is The Fugitive. He was excellent.
That is why Fugitive. He kept looking familiar to me. It's because I know him from The Fugitive. Okay.
Yeah. And he's so good at playing that slick, well-polished bad guy,
mm-hmm.
right? That he's, because he's from the Netherlands, so he's got that European look and sound to him, but that Dutch accent kind of can fit for just about anywhere in Europe. Like you can very easily make him mm-hmm. into anywhere vaguely European. So he's kind of chameleon like in that. And he has a great look to him, especially in this era, this early to mid 90s era. And he's so good at playing those characters because he is very charismatic and, but he can be just sort of like underhanded and sneaky. And so I loved him. And again, it's like I was saying, trim down some of the fat, make him be the guy that's getting exonerated at the beginning, coming out of the courthouse. He just happens to survive the attack at the house that Frank initially gives.
Can I tell you, like, one of the things that I find funny about this is we've talked about, like, uncramming the movie, uh-huh. but it's only 90 minutes.
I know. That's the amazing thing. Like, it's so much stuffed into 90 minutes because you've
maybe
got
if it
Johnny
had been
Franco.
2 hours, it might, if they had stretched it out across 2 hours, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, also, I don't know what the appetite would have been for a 2 hour movie back when this came out.
Yeah, that would have been a tough sell for a 2 hour action movie at that time. Because I mean, this is the era of, you know, Bloodsport and Kickboxer Bloodsport. And Steven Seagal,
yes.
you know, this is the height of all of those. And like 90 to 100 minutes was your tops. If you went beyond that, you better have a real good reason. And I don't know that they could have kept the pacing, because that is one thing. This movie never really bogs down. It keeps its pace pretty mm-hmm. well for having so much crammed into it.
That's true.
Story-wise. Because you've got the mobsters versus Frank. You've got the Yakuza versus the mobsters. You've got the Yakuza taking the mobsters' kids, kidnapping them. Frank having to like save the mobsters' mm-hmm. kids. Frank versus the police. Frank getting captured by the Yakuza, getting out of that, and then getting turning himself into the police, getting out of there with the help of the mobsters to go after the Yakuza to get the mobster's kid back because there's one kid left. Like, that's a lot in a 90-minute movie.
Can I tell you something else about that scene when he turns himself in that bemused me a bit? This guy's killed 125 sure. people. They've been looking for him for 5 years. You finally get him, and you let Lou Gossett's character go into that room by himself, and Frank's not restrained? Right. Like that would exactly. never happen. Never.
I mean, look, there's a lot in this movie that would never happen, right? Like,
I just thought that
Frank turning himself in the first place. But yeah, that was one of those. I was just like, okay, that's pretty silly. But you know, I'm going to suspend some disbelief. It's a comic book based movie. I think one of the things was this was an era where I'm trying to think of the first movie, probably the first Spider-Man, Sam Raimi Spider-Man, that really embraced like, hey, this is a comic book. We're going to make a comic book movie. Because prior to that, you had everything trying to adapt it, but in a way to make it not feel like a comic book. Like even X-Men, Blade in 98, all of these were trying to take. And look, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Like I think that first Blade movie is such a brilliant adaptation to take it off the page and put it into film. And like Blade crawled so that Deadpool could run.
Facts.
Right. Yeah. Like we don't get Deadpool doesn't happen if Blade doesn't come first 10 years earlier or whatever it is, 15 years earlier. But we had this obsession at one point with like, we need to distance ourselves from the comic book roots of it. And I think what you do is you do that, but you do that in parts. Like, for instance, I think that Dolph Lundgren casting as Frank Castle, good in this movie. I think he looks the part, right? You want Frank Castle to be big, to be intimidating, imposing, and look tough. And Dolph Lundgren does that. I think having Frank Castle in what looks like more sort of tactical gear or even sort of a mix between SWAT team and biker gang worked. Because at the comics at this point, he was wearing effectively what spandex with a giant skull on it, but he also had the white gloves and the white boots, which let's be honest.
That's a silly
look. Or for your hardcore, like I'm just going to kill everyone that's guilty kind of guy. It's pretty goofy to have him in bright white. Yeah. So I loved everything about the look of Lundgren in this, except for the lack of any skull anywhere. Like, well, he should have had something.
It was on the knives.
It was on the knives, but that was it. Like, there should have been something on the jacket or a shirt, or you could have had him have like a skull tattoo underneath there. Would have been a cool look. Like, you could have done something with that, because what it does is it makes somebody who's not a fan of the comics be like, okay, so it's just a dude in black leather. And if you're a fan of the comics, you're like, well, where's the skull?
That's true.
Where that is it? So I would have done something with it. Something beyond just the skull at the end of the knife hilt, which was a nice touch. I did like those. But I mean, outside of that, like the look, the leather jacket, the, you know, all the harness straps and the leather pants, the biker boots, the bike itself, I thought was a cool look. And how everything was black, but then like dirty and dusty, right? Like his bike wasn't just jet black. It looked like a bike
that bike looked like it had been around since the Vietnam War.
Yeah, and it wasn't like, it wasn't cleaned, it wasn't well-maintained, it ran, it started, and it went, but he didn't put a lot of TLC into that bike. It was much like his jacket having all the kind of scratches and cuts and dust all over it. Like, it's just stuff that he has, and he doesn't maintain it, but because he doesn't care.
Also, he's riding that bike through the city.
And I think that was... Right, exactly.
Right.
So what's the point of cleaning it? Because you're going to rear-ride it through a sewer. So I loved all that. Like, I loved all of that part of it. The black hair. I think Dolph, they kind of, the stubble almost gave him like a skull look to his face too, which was kind of interesting in some of those shots. I even thought like the voiceover wasn't great in that shot. They had it towards the beginning of the movie and then at the end of it where it's like the tracking shot through the sewers and it's voiceover from Frank. I love the look of that. And then like zooming in on him and he's sitting there naked, like in his pose, kind of meditating. I thought that was kind of interesting to me. The voiceover was maybe do another take, you know? Okay, let's do one more and have a little feeling to it. But like, I love the idea of that. I love and that's another part of it is like, correct me if I'm wrong. In the comics, Frank prior to sort of becoming the Punisher, even went so far as to being part of the church and kind of being like a church going sort of citizen in his military background. And then, because I remember in Punisher Warzone, for instance, he meets with like a priest and he talks about being in the seminary at one point.
I'm trying to remember Punisher Warzone. But Warzone is like, I feel like Warzone is like is it the third iteration? So might there be. Is.
So I might be.
There's Punisher. I should know. I have all these comics. So there's the initial, I want to say like 6-issue miniseries that they run. That's done. I want to say the art's done by Mike Zeck. Because those books were a pain in the butt to find. And then there's Punisher War Journal. That comes after that. And then I want to say Warzone is later. Like Warzone might be like mid late 90s.
Okay. Was War Journal the one that Garth Ennis did?
No.
Garth Ennis kind of.
The Garth Ennis one is a Punisher Max series. I think that was no. Is that
And I just looked it up, by the way. He did start as a character in 1974. Oh. So I was a couple years off. Jerry Conway, John Romita, and Ross Andrew created him for Spider-Man in 74.
Maybe it wasn't a Max series. But I remember the series that you're talking about Garth Ennis did. Because Garth Ennis, like, he gives the whole, like, the Vietnam thing for Punisher. Like, he takes it all the way back for that. But I can't.
Oh, wow. That's later than I thought. It's like
the Garth Ennis one?
Yeah, Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon. It was just titled The Punisher, and that was 2000-2001 era, kind of April. Knights. And that was under Marvel Knights, which makes sense. Yeah. So he kind of – and then after that was Punisher and Punisher Max, which was also Garth Ennis.
Okay.
So – okay. No, that makes sense. But like it's an interesting character because of sort of the ways you can go with him too. Because you can make him very like they've gone super hardcore with him, they've gone more lighthearted with him. You can go like one of the things I loved about so there have been 4 major iterations live action on screen. I don't know how many animated versions have happened because I'm not fully up on all that, but like you've got Punisher 89, Thomas Jane's Punisher, Punisher Warzone, and then the Netflix stuff with Bernthal. Those are sort of the 4. And Tom Jane's Punisher was real, kind of trying to be that real gritty, little over the top with Travolta, but overall really trying to kind of ground it. I honestly enjoyed Punisher Warzone for what it was because it's just bonkers. Like they leaned into the comic book
nature the violence
of
right.
the Punisher where, because it's hyper violent, it's hyper realistic. And then you balance that out by having Jigsaw just be a cartoon character and Looney Bin Jim is like just a goofball. And it balances out that hyper violence so well. And I gotta say, Ray Stevenson,
rest in peace.
Like, first of all, yes, rest in peace. But if you want to take Frank Castle and put him on screen visually, Ray Stevenson with that flak jacket with the high collar and like that scrawled on skull, like they just nailed the look there. It was so good. And again, Stevenson is 6'4", and he's got that imposing look, and he's just got that RBF all the time, mm-hmm. and he just looks mean. Because Thomas Jane brought a great intensity to it, and I think Thomas Jane is good. There was something about Stevenson that I liked better. And then Bernthal, I kind of give him a little bit of sort of, he's on his own, right? Because like, he didn't have just a single movie to do it in. Yeah. Lundgren, Thomas Jane, and Stevenson had one movie, an hour and a half to 2 hours to try and portray this character. John Bernthal got a couple episodes of Daredevil plus his own series for two.
Did he get two runs? Runs?
Like, and he, yeah, there were okay. two seasons. Yeah. And I mean, he brings so much depth to that character because he's able to explore it more. And like, one of the things with Frank Castle that I love as a character is he's not a hero, right? He's not somebody to look up to. He's not a, mm-hmm. he's not Superman. He's not Captain America. He's really not a good guy, but he's doing stuff that kind of almost needs to be done yep. in a way. And so because of that, he's very tortured. And I thought Stevenson did a great job with that in certain aspects in War Zone with like, he kind of hated what he had become, but he also knew it was necessary to get what he wanted done. Thomas Jane dove into that a little bit. And I think had he been able to continue the character, he could have done it well. And Bernthal just got to. He got to really live within all of that stuff and show the torture that, you know, Frank is going through. And it's unfortunate when other actors don't get to do that. And you see pieces of it. You see the bits and pieces and like, oh, man, they could do yeah. so good if they were just given the chance. Which is why I don't think Dolph was no. bad in this. And he just needed more time to give that torture. And that's where, again, more story for Frank and Jake and versus the mob, as opposed to the Yakuza and all the extra stuff, because we just got too many things going on at once to really follow any one character. So Frank becomes a little bit one note in this, just a little bit. And same thing with Lady Tanaka. Like, she's just kind of there to be yeah. bad. And be evil. Sam Leary, Nancy Everhard's character, what's the point of her? Why is she in this movie? She's got a scene where she's like, I want to be your partner. And the whole crux of that scene is her saying, I believe Frank Castle is the Punisher. And then she's kind of forgotten until Frank is being transported. And she's like, look, Berkowitz was, he cared about you and all this.
She is the one that figures out that he's in the sewers.
How do you know any of that?
Because I think the other linchpin yeah. for her is that her youth allows the believability that she would like use the computer and figure out the algorithm and all that stuff to like extrapolate that, oh, he's under the city, right? Like, yeah,
that's a good
point. They really didn't give her enough. Like, they could have given her. They could have given him.
No. They could have. And I think it would have been kind of interesting to have a little bit more for her and have, again, we needed more uh-huh. focus on Frank, Berkowitz, and Leary, and those three versus whatever bad guys you want, instead of having both the sort of European Italian mafia and the Yakuza. Like, maybe have something happen with the Yakuza and tease to be able to yeah. do that later on, maybe towards the end, something like that, or have the Yakuza be the bad guys all the way through it. But it was just a little bit too much. Like, Dino Moretti as a character doesn't really need to be there. You could combine him with Franco and make them one character. And then you've got Barry Otto's Shake, the because anytime you've got a vigilante, that vigilante has to have their guy yeah. on the street that has the information for him, right? Like Sherlock Holmes had uh-huh. the Baker Street irregulars, the kids that ran around and could collect information for him. All your vigilantes always have to have those couple of guys. In the Netflix produced Marvel stuff, mm-hmm. it was Turk, who is easily my favorite character of those series. I love that he shows up in all of them, but like Turk was great because he was that low level criminal, just kind of like, yeah, I get guns for people and, but I never really do anything that bad. Yeah. Like he was great. And it was just cool to have that, that connective tissue tying everything together. But like, you always have that character. And in this, it's Shake, played by Barry Otto. What was his deal? Why did he speak in rhyme? Because he was an actor?
It was so weird. Trying to tell us that like he had a mental issue.
I would have bought that. I would have absolutely bought it. Because the thing about it is, like, we meet him in the bar, and then he gets thrown out of the bar, and he meets with Frank. And that first scene with Frank, when he meets him, it's almost like he doesn't know who mm-hmm. Frank is at first, but then he does. And Frank, like, lured him with the – I love the little radio-controlled pickup truck with the bottle of whiskey in it. That was clever. That was cute. But, like, he doesn't – but then the next time we see him, he's speaking in rhyme for no reason whatsoever. Yeah. He just is. And I was like, that's just weird. I don't get it. Like, I get it's the quirk of him being an actor, but you don't always have to explain and hold my hand for everything, but a little bit of helpful. Explanation would be nice. Just a little bit.
Just a smidge.
just a touch, you know. Also, one other actor I got to mention because I saw this and my geeky ass noticed it right away is one of the – so there's Johnny Franco and then there's like the four other mm-hmm. mob guys. And they have a couple of scenes before they all go to some meeting with Lady Tanaka at the restaurant and then they're all gunned down at the restaurant or killed by the poison. One of those mob guys was played by Lanny Tupu. And he was the one with dark hair. And I don't think he actually has any speaking lines, but he's Lacone or Lacone. Lanny Tupu is, if you're a fan of Farscape, the series, Lanny Tupu was all over that. He played the character of Bylar Krace, and he also was the voice and of the pilot of Moya. And because I'm such a big fan of that, I saw him and he's so young looking here and he's completely clean shaven that it took me two scenes to realize who it was. Like that is that? And I had to look it up. And I'm like, sure enough. Yeah, it's Lanny Tupu. Although at the time he was credited as Larny Tupu, which is a weird way to redo his name. Like they're throwing letters in there that don't even belong. But I always love finding actors like that. Noticing those. That was fun for me.
Did you know your guy from the Highlander was the original want as the lead? I can't remember his name.
I read that.
Christopher
Lambert. I read that just before we started recording tonight, that Lambert was originally wanted for the lead of this. I cannot picture him as Frank Castle. I really can't. It's real because the thing is, when I think of Frank Castle, I think of somebody the size of Dolph Lundgren, Ray Stevenson, even like Thomas Jane isn't that big, but he plays and Bernthal isn't that big either, but they play very intimidating. And like John Bernthal plays up. Like he's very, like he weighs more than he does. You know what I mean? Like the way he moves, it's sort of like, I talked about this with friends of mine when I first saw The Dark Knight Rises. One of my things I mentioned was like Bane as the heavy in the movie really felt like that because the way Tom Hardy moved around and carried himself, he had all that bulk and that weight, and you felt that when he moved. And I feel that with John Bernthal when he's playing Frank Castle. He feels like somebody who, you know, even if he's not that big, it's like he's a mason and he's been working with, you know, or a carpenter or something, been working with his hands forever. And you just know, like, if he punched you, it feels like a cement block hitting you. And Lambert, I love Christopher Lambert. I can't see him in that because his intensity is a very different type of intensity. I just can't, I can't picture him as Frank Castle. It's just, it didn't make sense. I read that and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. I can't see that, other than he was popular enough and probably within the price range they could afford. Although weirdly, all the names I saw that were supposed to have been Frank Castle for this movie are all European actors. Why is that?
Yeah.
For a character that's supposed to be, you know, US Marine, NYPD cop. And all we can think of are, it'd be like having Rocky, like making a Rocky movie and, you know, this all American down on his luck boxer. And I think some of it may have been
that at the time when you thought of action stars, especially for a role like this, you probably think, oh, Schwarzenegger. Like, you want somebody big and powerful,
that's a good point.
Might lead you to looking, you know, European, Eastern European. I mean, Thomas Jane.
You're not that far off.
What about Stevenson?
Yes.
Because
Ray Stevenson is not. Yeah. Ray Stevenson's Irish, yeah. I believe. You're not that, you know, that's a good point though. If you think about, let's look at say 84 to like 94 and your action stars at the time, even in US movies, Schwarzenegger, Stallone,
yep.
But then Van Damme was a big action star. So that makes sense. I could see that. Yeah, you bring up a good point there. And even Lundgren. Lundgren was becoming an action star at this point, between being Drago, Masters of the Universe, which bombed, but it was at least known. Red Scorpion. You know, I watched it not that long ago for this show, and it's sort of one of those, it's not good, but it's not as bad as everyone says. And like, Lundgren isn't as bad as people want to make him out to be. He can be a little bit wooden, and it was early in his career.
He looked like, man.
He's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. He looked the part. He's no worse than Van Damme at all, especially in that era.
Right.
He's no worse than Stallone in that era, if I'm being completely honest. Like,
funny enough, if you watch the Expendables movies, one might argue that Lundgren's acting is better than Stallone's in a lot of those scenes.
By the time of the Expendables, absolutely. Like, that is one of the things, watching his career over time, because you look at him as Ivan Drago in 1985, and then realize that 10 years later, he was the street preacher, Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, yeah.
The same guy played both of those characters. And the street preacher is so different from Drago. And you saw, I do enjoy seeing when, we have a problem as movie audiences of pigeonholing actors, right? You think of your big, burly action stars as like, that's all they can do.
Yeah.
And we talked about last time you were on with Copland, like Stallone acting. Like, Stallone acts the hell out of that movie. And he really came into his own and that kind of stuff. Lundgren, or the current version of Dolph Lundgren, I would say, is somebody like a Dave Bautista. Who, when Big Dave started in movies, he was playing a lot of the same characters and he wasn't known for his acting, but he wanted to be known for that. So he took roles like Sapper in Blade Runner 2049 and these roles that aren't necessarily what he would normally be cast as. Lundgren, I feel like, kind of went that route in some ways. In other ways, he did. Like, Showdown in Little Tokyo, straight up action movie. A lot of the stuff he did, a lot of the direct-to-video stuff he did, but he kept working on his craft and he got better and he got more natural in front of the camera. And when I see him in things like, and this was the first comic, okay, technically second comic book thing, because Master of the Universe was before it. But like, if you look at comic book based properties Dolph Lundgren has been in, Masters of the Universe, The Punisher, he ended up doing Arrow for a few episodes. He was Constantine Kobar the Arrow series, which I liked. Mm-hmm. He shows up in Aquaman as King Nerys. Like, you know, he's got a range of stuff that he has been in. Plus, you know, coming into going back to some action roots and doing the Expendables movies, which I loved him in those. Like, I loved him in that first Expendables. And he's got the greatest. He doesn't have it, but it's Eric Roberts' line about him in the first Expendables movies, Crack
Me. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where he talks about, like, seeing just a giant in the room. Because just Dolph Lundgren in the same room as Arnold and or Sylvester or all these guys, like, you get the realization of how big certain people are and how small other people are in Hollywood. Because Dolph is just a freaking giant. But I didn't love him in this, but I didn't dislike him either. I thought he was good. I just feel like maybe he needed, I don't know if there was some changes made to the movie midway.
Yeah.
That maybe didn't jive with what he was going for or what. Cause there's moments in this where he's fantastic. Like, I love that last moment with the kid when he's had the fight with Johnny and he's shot Johnny and then the kid grabs the gun. And again, like, it's real good. And he turns to him and he basically tells him, like, go ahead, do it. You need to do this now. And like that whole moment, there's a lot of, there's emotion there that I felt was really good. There's just other moments where it's like, he's missing stuff, but then he can also be funny when he's getting tortured and he's just got nothing but wisecracks. Who sent you? Batman. I love that. It was so good. So, you know, there's that kind of stuff too. And I didn't mention this earlier, but I got to mention the music.
Yeah.
The music in this movie is pretty good. Like the score was, I kind of want to find that score and listen to it a little bit more because this is an era where scores were meant to be memorable. And I really enjoyed that. Who did the music for this? I'm trying to remember now. I'll find it here in a second, but they did a great job making something that was pretty memorable. I just had
not music. A name that I know, Dennis but it's a good score.
Did the music? Yeah, no, I don't know that name either. But it's kind of like I don't know Ian Baker as a cinematographer, but I thought the cinematography for this definitely looked as good as any other kind of action movie of the late 80s. It felt right in line with, I mentioned Bloodsport earlier, or like a lot of your Steven Seagal type, you know, Above the Law, Out for Justice, those movies. Like it feels like one of those visually. On top of definitely R-rated, definitely bloody, not terrible by today's standards. But for 1989, pretty bloody. So, yeah. Do you have a favorite moment in this? Was there anything that really stood out to you?
I do really like the fight scene at the end when Frank is fighting the adopted daughter. I can't remember what
Oh yeah, I don't.
I thought that was. I thought that was a pretty good fight. I enjoyed that.
No one really. She doesn't have any.
Oh wow! Yeah. Well, listen. They didn't give her anything to say either. So.
So there you go. No, they didn't. Because there was a few moments like that where, like there was just weird stuff because they go into the Yakuza stronghold and it's Frank and Johnny, which again, I got to spend a little bit because I feel like there's no way Frank Castle would work with a mob boss, but okay. For the purposes of this movie, I'll let that go. They get in there. I loved the aesthetic of like the lights go out. So the emergency lights come on. So everything's got that red glow to it. I loved that look. But when they disappear and the guys shoot and don't hit anything, and then they come out from the side panels, like how did they get in there in the first place? How did they disappear like that? All right, sure, whatever. And then when Frank takes the one guy out and then pulls out the butterfly knife and stabs the other guy through the wall, like, why did that guy just stand there and wait to get stabbed?
Yeah.
Was one of my notes. Like, why? I don't know. But who cares? He did it. This is very much... Okay. It's very much an 80s action movie, and you can tell that if for no other reason than nothing, bullets or knives or anything, touch our main character, our hero, unless there's a plot reason for him to get shot or stabbed.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like straight out of Commando, right? Commando is one of those where like, doesn't matter how many bullets are getting shot at Arnold in Commando, nothing touches him unless the script says it's supposed to. And I always, that always cracks me up. And that definitely happened here, because there's so many times where people are like 10 feet from Frank firing off from a semi-automatic or an automatic weapon. Don't touch a thing. So yeah, it's fine. I don't mind. It's silly, but silly in a fun way. Cause that, I think end of the day, that's what I really enjoyed about this movie, was just, it just had a cool look to it. Like, it had that gritty late '80s generic kind of action movie.
It's a good flick. It's a shame that it's not really available anywhere.
So, that is the bummer of it, right? Like, we found it. It is available on YouTube. There's a couple people that have uploaded it.
I was quite surprised at how good the quality is.
So,
yeah, I've got to go back and see if I can find my DVD. It's either in the binder of all the DVDs that I don't watch anymore, because, you know, DVDs don't look great, or it is still sitting at my parents' house over the TV. So I gotta figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I had a note that the police captain that shows up in that one scene with Lou Gossett Jr. and tells him, like, you know, Frank Castle's officially dead, that guy. He made me think of Jason Robards, but like the wish.com version of him. If you're not sure who that is, look him up. You'll know who I mean. You'll recognize the face even if you don't know the name.
He's been in a bunch
of stuff. It's just what he reminded me of. I'm trying to think if there's any other. It's not a whole. Oh, okay. So I captured some audio. There's some audio we got to listen to, because it's weird. There's quips in this movie, but it's not like a quippy movie. But there's some good moments in there. For one, while I talked about how Dino Moretti as a character kind of could have been combined with Johnny Franco, the actor playing him, Brian Marshall, there was something with his voice that felt like an FM radio DJ, like a drive time DJ voice, almost too good. And so I had to capture, like, when he first walks out of the courthouse and the reporter comes up to him, he's like, "How do you feel?" And he responds with,
"It feels great."
It feels great. Like, it felt like a voiceover. There was some ADR in this that I also captured. That was something else. But I got one more, Brian Marshall, and, it's just the way he says 1,000 yards, which, again, ballsy move by a guy who, for all intents and purposes, should probably know that the Punisher is real and coming after him. And he's just gotten out of prison. And he says on live TV, like, this is some Tony Stark in Iron Man 3 level balls to be like,
"If he ever shows up within 1,000 yards of me, he'll find out what the word punished really means."
Very, very northy. That was almost,
it was the
Boston
way he said 1,000 yards. Yeah, it was getting there. The character of Sam Leary, introducing herself to Lou Gossett Jr. and just his reaction to her when she says,
"Oh man,
I was the hooker."
"Oh, right."
You know how much crap they could get for that line today?
Lou was so good in this. He really was.
I'm not sure that line would get out of the room today.
Oh, there's a few. There's a few moments in this. No, that wouldn't have made it out of the writer's room. There's a few things in this movie that definitely date it. There's a moment where I feel like it's almost traditional Chinese music being played over the Japanese Yakuza, which felt a little strange. Drop an F slur at one point about the French, which definitely wouldn't make it today. But the hooker one too. I was the hooker. Oh yeah. Like that's how he remembers her. Was just, that cracked me up. When all the mobsters get together, which again, here's a cool like plot idea, right? Mm-hmm. The mob in New York are trying to consolidate and work together. I thought it was kind of neat. Like the idea of the head of one of the families being like, no, the idea of crime families needs to go away. That's old. We need to move forward. I thought it was kind of cool. And then it sort of gets swept under the rug because of the Yakuza thing. But all of them working together. So you've got different factions of organized crime guys at the dock. And of course they're all going to butt heads. Right. And they're arguing. And then the one guy says,
"There's $500 million out there, assholes. Cool out."
Cool out.
I don't think so.
Did anyone?
Only
ever,
people that didn't understand the term cool was chill out. Out. Maybe.
I've never heard just, that before. Yeah, cool.
Yes. Cool out is.
Chill out? Yeah, yes. Cool off? Yes. But cool out, I've never heard. I did love the, like, mobsters are kind of worthless and idiots angle that some things went through, like the whole scene where they're checking in on the radio as Frank is taking guys out. That cracked me up, where like they go to Red 2, "How's your section?" And Red 2 responds with like,
"Dead here."
Yeah.
And then immediately gets shot, or "It's fine here," and then gets an arrow to the chest. Like that, I love that. That was just silly and so much fun. This one I got because this is from later on when Frank goes to rescue the kids. So he steals a bus. He drives the bus to wherever he's going. And then he goes inside the building, somehow knew where to go, which was impressive. He had a lot of surveillance. I had a note at one point, like, how does he have a bug in the room with all the mobsters?
Right.
And if he has a, a listening device in that room, what does he need the out of work actor for? To feed him information. But he steals the bus, he gets to the building, he goes in after the kids, and the kids are being moved from one room to another, and Frank shows up, kills the two captors, and then immediately tells the kids,
"It's all right, don't be afraid."
Yeah.
No, if I'm those kids, I am deathly afraid.
For sure.
Nothing about this is good, like, at all. On top, like, I've been kidnapped, I'm being taken somewhere else, and then the guys that are taking me there get shot by a 6.5-foot giant with all sorts of weapons on him. I'm going to be scared. Him getting tortured. This came before that, but him getting tortured and just.
"Who sent you?"
"Batman."
Batman. Yeah. So in this world, Batman is a fictional character.
I'm actually surprised nobody got sued behind that.
I kind of am too, if I'm honest. It was pretty ballsy to do that at the time. But I think this came out, Batman was summer of 89. So they would have been in production about the same time anyway. But yeah, it's pretty funny. I loved, so Frank's getting tortured. He's on that stretch machine, right? He somehow manages to undo the wing nut with one hand, which is an impressive amount of strength, and get himself out. And
yeah,
we have him put the other guy on the rack, and he's stretching him out. And then for whatever reason, that guy was wearing bright red,
I didn't get that,
high heels.
maybe that was like one of those Game of Thrones, like somebody didn't
understand what that was
clear
about.
The scene correctly before they started shooting, and they were like, "Oh, we're not reshooting."
Something I don't, but I love that. And then when he's leaving, or no, this isn't Frank. This is later on. This is when they have Berkowitz. That's right. So jump ahead a little bit. Berkowitz is captured by the mob, by the Yakuza. And he gets out of that by telling the guy he's got to take a leak. And the mobster's like, all right. And he undoes like, the cuffs. And I love the line of, is there an IQ test for this job? And yeah. And then he just takes the gun from him. But I love the end of that scene where he's walking out. And then the other guy, the other mobster, comes walking in with,
"Hey man, I got the pizza."
Right.
Like, dude, if you didn't want pizza, you could just have said so. You didn't have to beat the crap out of him. But the best part about that is the guy's walking in with the pizza box, like, "Hey, I got the pizza." Berkowitz just beats the shit out of him. And then
he's like,
reaches
"I don't
down,
care."
Grabs a slice
from
of the pizza.
I'm hungry.
And he's eating it as he walks out of the room. That's my favorite.
That's fair.
Part.
That's fair.
Yo. It was so good. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I liked this line. This is towards the end when Frank and Franco, so Castle and Franco are riding up in the elevator, and he puts the key in because they need that key to go to the 41st floor. And he looks at Castle and he tells him,
"There's a limit to revenge."
"Well, I guess I haven't reached mine yet."
There's a limit to revenge. And that makes sense in the context of this movie. Like,
he's
Frank has basically taken out everybody that killed his family. He doesn't really need to keep going, but that's part of who the Punisher, right? Because that's the Punisher. Like, it's sort of like in the Burton Batman films when they make the Joker the one who killed Bruce's parents, because Bruce becomes Batman due to his parents' death. When the Joker dies, he really should have been done with his whole thing. But by that point, he's so far down that road, he can't come back from it. And that's Frank. Frank is so far down this road of punishing the guilty and deciding who is guilty that he hasn't reached his limit of revenge. So he's just going to keep going. And I enjoyed that line. I thought that was pretty good. The kids. So the kids getting kidnapped was sort of like meant to be a really big plot point, but then kind of forgotten in a few ways. But there was some real bad ADR on one of those kids. I'm sure you noticed it, but the one girl was very clearly ADR'd by like an adult. And I could not help but capture it. Because it's like Tommy is telling her to calm down, don't worry about it, and she says,
"Yeah,
I'm not going to be okay. It's because of my father that I'm here."
Yeah,
that's clearly like a 30-year-old woman. Yeah, like it's not even like Nancy Cartwright doing the voice of Bart Simpson. At least Nancy Cartwright kind of sounds like a young boy, and so you can work that in when she's doing the voice of Bart. But that, whoever did the ADR for that girl, and then later on they did the same one with,
"I came back from my dolly."
It's so bad. It's so bad. And it stuck out to me. So I had to capture that. As well as, normally I will find laughs. I love like fake stage laughs from people where they're overdoing it. In this one, we didn't have any of that. But instead, what we got is action movie grunts. And those are my second favorite thing to a fake acting laugh, is the ADR sounds of fighting and the grunting and groaning that you'll do for all of that. Because you can just imagine, I can just picture somebody having to sit in a recording booth and watch footage of like an action scene and add in the, you know, the hits, the sound of getting hit and all of that. So I captured a couple of those because these are too good for Dolph. There was this one. It's a little tough to hear because there's music score, but that listen to that one again. Or when he's getting beat up by the Yakuza at the carnival, like the funhouse, which was a cool set, by the way, where they're like sliding down that slide and they surround him and all that. And then they're beating the crap out of him. And you hear stuff like,
yeah, it's very like old. There's
something
Fu.
About that.
It, like that snippet in like that.
I wonder if that was actually Dolph.
It feels very like Kung Fu movie.
Yes. And there was also this one. That's very 70s Kung Fu movie. I don't know who that is or what sound he's supposed to be making, but I loved it. I loved every second of that stuff. It's honestly, this was a lot of fun. Like this movie doesn't deserve the
most
the 80, reputation 80s, of being 90s really
action
bad.
Movies aren't.
Is it great?
Like, I mean, you really think about it, they're not.
But right, exact. Yeah, if you take it in a vacuum, they're not. And in that context, in putting it in context with something like a Commando, or like, it's not at the level of an 80s action film like a Predator. Mm-hmm. I think Predator had a polish to it that puts it a step above this, but this is in there. This is certainly up there with anything Steven Seagal did in terms of like the look and the feel of it. It just got a little bit bloated in the story. And I think if you had the visual of the skull on Frank somewhere and trim that story down a little bit, this could be really good. Now, the reason that I put it fourth in my Punisher pantheon is Punisher Warzone for me, I feel like, is super underrated. And I did go see that in the theater. And so I've got kind of that connection to it. And I think the Thomas Jane Punisher was one that I didn't love at first, but has grown on me a little bit over time. I think it's another one that's not as bad as its reputation would lead you to believe. And because it had a little more budget and a little more behind it, and it also has about 15 years of action movie pedigree.
Yeah.
And sort of distillation to where the action sequences, I think, worked a little bit better in that one. They were just more polished. And it's like looking at a, Star Wars in 1977 and the way they could shoot things versus what you can do in 2017. The polish in something newer is probably going to be there just because you've got that much more time to refine it, and the people making it have had more time to learn and stand on the shoulders of those that came before them. So something like this is real good, and it fits into its era perfectly. It just Thomas Jane's, and then Warzone, and then finally the Netflix series just were able to iterate on that and refine it a little bit better. But that doesn't make this bad by any stretch. I would watch this again. I would watch this again in today.
Yeah,
like,
and
right
I'm, and I'm gonna, I put it above the Thomas Jane one.
Now, you said you had it third in yours. What one would
now,
you put
granted,
it above?
Maybe I need to go back and watch the Thomas Jane one again. But the Travolta really throws me off that Thomas Jane one.
Yeah, it would be like if Johnny Franco or Dino Moretti or whatever was even more over the top than they already were. Like, the stuff with Lady Tanaka in this borders on that when she's dressed as a geisha toward the end of it, but it never quite goes full on the way that Howard Saint was. So I can get that. That's fair. It's perfectly fair. But as now, in terms of if you look at Batman in 1989 as sort of, because you know how like movies will come along that have that watershed moment where that's sort of like the before and after this movie, right? Like Star Wars, sci-fi pre-Star Wars is something, and then everything after Star Wars sort of made a difference. The Matrix is that, right? Everything pre-Matrix, post-Matrix, or Jurassic Park is another one of those. Like creature features before and after, or special effects-driven movies before and after. So I feel like Batman 89 is one of those, too. You sort of had, you had Superman, and then there was about a 10-year gap, and then you had Batman, and then you've got another 10-year gap before, say, either X-Men or Spider-Man in that range. So you're sort of pre and post Batman 89, and this fits right in there where it's like, Batman 89, I think, is a better movie. I think it's just, and it had the benefit of more money behind it, more time behind it, a kind of a more focused direction. But what they were going for in this, I think they nailed pretty well. And I think that it's very enjoyable. If you can find it, and I will put a link to the YouTube video of it in the show notes for this episode. If you get a chance and you've got, you know, it's an hour and a half long, so it's not like you're into it for a super, super long movie. It's fun. It's just know that it's an 80s action.
Yeah, maybe if you watch
that happens to have a character named Frank Castle in it, and I think you'll enjoy it.
Don't focus on the fact that it's supposed to be a Punisher movie. It is, it may be an even better movie in that regard.
Yeah. I think so. I think that kind of not thinking about it as a Punisher movie helps it a little bit. But either way, I think it's worth seeing for anybody that loves 80s action. I think if you're an 80s action fan, this is worth seeing. I would say that. If you're not, if you can't get behind watching something like Commando, skip this.
That's fair.
You're just not going to get enough out of it because you're going to be spending too much. Yeah. Like if you overanalyze your movies, which I've definitely been guilty of doing in the past, you're going to have to park your brain for this one. Cause there's moments where you're like, no, hold on. There's a moment in this movie that really the movie should have ended about 15 minutes in when the first time when when Moretti walks out of his house and he's got the knife in his back and he falls down. This is after like all the explosions have gone on the first time in the house and you got all the press out there and then you see the silhouette of Frank and just barely see his face. And then he steps back into the house and they're like, it's the Punisher. Yeah. And then the house explodes.
Yep.
Not just catches on fire, but the house is like, there is no house left. Frank is dead at that point. Like just straight up, there is no more Frank Castle. He is dead. But because it's a movie and because it's a movie based on a comic book, he survived that. No problems, not a scratch on him. So I kind of appreciate the movie doing that right away so that we can suspend our disbelief immediately. Like if he survived that, he can survive anything. So let's do it. But yeah, this was a lot of fun. I'm so glad you brought this up because you mentioned this. You were like, hey, dude, have you ever seen the 89 Punisher? I was like,
No, I'm always game.
Because, man, I don't need much of an excuse to get you on the show at all. And when you bring something like this, I'm game again. And so this was super fun. Thank you so much for finally getting me to watch this damn movie.
Yes.
Absolutely. So now you've got a show, Joystick and Mouse.
Diddy Does Games.
Remind people where they can find that. Every other week.
We're actually recording tomorrow over on his Twitch channel. It's Diddy Does Games, and I'm sure Travel dropped that in the notes. But yeah, every other Monday, it's a podcast about dads who don't really have enough time to game, but we try. So, and we go off onto our own little tangents about things that have nothing to do with gaming. So
boy, it's awesome. It's a great show. Definitely check it out. I will have a link for that, for the stream and for the podcast itself in the show notes. So check that out. Joystick and Mouse.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get Don back on. He has said he enjoys doing this show. I gotta reconnect with him. Yeah, it was great having him on not too long ago talking about Aquaman. I got him to watch Aquaman, which was really fun. And we actually talked about maybe doing the second Aquaman.
It's
because neither. No.
Yeah. One. When y'all watch that, let me know. Neither, so. I'm interested to see your opinions.
But yeah. Sounds good. Sounds good. Now, this show I stream live Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern time, twitch.tv/TV's Travis. You can come hang out in the chat or at youtube.com/@TV's Travis is also live there. Then the show comes out as a podcast on Wednesdays, all over anywhere you get your podcast, including a video version on YouTube as well. So definitely check that out. Next week, I've got Ryan Estrada coming on, and we're going to talk about the Hudsucker Proxy. It's a Coen movie that, I haven't seen, and I just did Blood Simple a couple of weeks ago. Their first movie, I hadn't seen that. And the Hudsucker Proxy is like one of the few other Coen's films that I haven't seen. That was on his short list of, right? I will talk at length about that movie. And I was like, well, let's do it. Cause I love Tim Robbins and I love the Coen brothers. So that's what's coming up next week is the Hudsucker Proxy. I've also got Labyrinth coming up in a couple of weeks. I'm going to be doing that one live from Las Vegas. So that'll be a lot of fun. So definitely check those out. And if you want to financially back the show, you can do that at patreon.com/WYHS, little as a dollar an episode. And you can help me doing things like the live Vegas or the live Dragon Con that I'm doing later this year. You can also just go to tvstravis.com, follow the show there, see what stuff I'm working on. There's links to merchandise if you want to get my silly logo on something. You can always do that. So check all those out. tvstravis.com and all the social medias.
Sounds great.
tvstravis.
Always happy to be here.
Jay Dimes, man, this was tons of fun. We'll do this again sometime soon for sure. Excellent. And until next week, until the Hudsucker Proxy, just remember to enjoy your movies and let's be excellent to each other. This has been Wait, You Haven't Seen.
I gotta take a leak.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.